My name is Tosh Jordan. I'm on staff here. And this is a sampling of some of the poems and stories that I've written in the last several years. I'd like to... The way I'd like to do this is to read some four sets, basically. First, poems that have kind of a religious or theological base. Then some poems that reflect more my personal experience in the world, how I relate to things and to the world and to the environment in which I find myself. The third set will be about people that I know or have known. And the last set is poems and stories about places and situations where I've been. I'd like to begin by reading an introduction to the second gathering of literary things that I have. The first gathering of the earliest material I called Sagenhaft, which is a German word that means legendary or pertaining to legends. The second collection is called New Pens, and that was a gathering of poems and stories that I began in, the first thing from this is in late May of 1983. Most of the things in that set were written while I was in Seattle in the winter of 83-84. And the third collection I've just begun recently, about a year ago, and it's called Behind Stained Glass. I'll be reading from all three, and they're all mixed up according to type, so I won't be referring you to them one at a time. I'd like to begin with the introduction to New Pens, which was written in April 84 in Seattle. Why do people write? Narrow it down a little. Why do people write bits of fiction, prose, and poetry as a way of expressing themselves and their view of the worlds around and inside them? Narrow it down some more. Get specific. Why do I write? Me, Tosh Mark Daniel Jordan. What is it about taking scraps of sounds and putting them together in ways that sometimes make sense and sometimes are meaningless to everybody but me? What do I get out of it? It used to be that writing was a way for me to get away from and at the same time make some sense of the usually conflicting paradigms of the world around me. It used to be that between thinking about the earth as a temporary unwanted shelter and trying to somehow reconcile my sense of differentness, disconnectedness to the feelings inside and those from the people I was or wanted to be close to, the world was best gotten away from, intellectualized, symbolized, and writing was a way to do that. Many nights, and more than a few afternoons, too, I'd sit at my desk with the shades pulled, a candle or two, for whatever reason, and play with ideas rather than other people. Old things, stifling things, mysterious things, to the point of suffocation. Alone things, denial things. But things change. Lots of changes in the past year or so. Sexuality losing ground as being hateful. Honest, open relationships with other people, gaining ground as being wonderful, necessary, fun even, something to strive for, as Joni Mitchell says. Then last November, Primal Therapy, Pacific Northwest Yoke Fellow and I trying to make some sense out of things and ending up feast first in reality, of all things, reality. Good God, and struggling to stay there. That's where this comes from, this new collection. The times are changing again, back to the mountains, from a very enriching time here in Seattle. New feelings, new laughter, new cooking, new music, and new pens. The first set, then, poems and stories that have a religious or theological basis. Matins. Oh God, it's time already. Just look at the clock. I'd swear it's only been a minute. Now, what to have for breakfast? My shaver needs recharging. Is there enough hot water? Dirty dishes in the sink, left over from last night's prowl. Old popcorn in the carpet. Pens and papers everywhere. My keys are in here someplace. Why don't I have a bureau? Please, Lord, let the bus be late, just this once. But not so late to miss the downtown transfer. Oh yes, and hear my plodding and my blunt humanity somehow as alleluia. Vespers. The walking, night without direction, calm and slow, a pace of fragments. Hesitant and fearless, I own my steps. I cannot draw as I was drawn. Cathedral stillness, city sounds beyond the gravel curb, a resting schoolyard, pensive starlight, incense from my cigarette, a prayer lent me an evensong. A fragile forest, hewn and time-worn, tired swings and gentle play bars, silent as I, welcoming an older child of slower play, my thoughts as smooth and weather soft. Walks unmake me. Sitting stays me. I would not. I would. God is a percussionist. Dedicated to Dan Erlander. God is a percussionist. He is a woman with a flair for the dramatic. Cymbals crashing at just the right moment, hammered blades of sound opening wide in exultation, glimmer of a smile after almost countless measures of active silence. God is a percussionist. She is a gentleman standing tall in the back of the orchestra, stealing attention in a quiet moment with soft mallets on the old soul of a marimba, pulling light through a dream. God is a percussionist. The coy one snares us with love, tunes our lives like kettle drums, and lets us play. And if we break an instrument or lose our place, it's all right. All things make sound, and there's no score. Advent in the city. It's raining again this year. The wet clearness falling hard on my umbrella and the windows. The backside of my arm catches the runoff from your package. My shoes fill at the crosswalk. Exhaust and wet air invade my senses. No cinnamon or pine. The bayberry is tired. The waiting never stops. An addition to a list, the Christ, arriving on a Sunday afternoon. No change on the New York market. Empty postcards with fancy addresses, waiting to see how I'll squeeze the season and myself and even God through a pen in a meaningful way. Lord, have mercy. What gift? Images of country roads, raven hollows, a wild fern, trail corner sunshine, dreaming vegetation, jewelry like rivers on a boundary, like a river flowing down the entropy, moving towards a civil degradation. The jungle of a city park, a landscape architect's domain. Where is the cliff behind it all? The ocean or the glacier? A hike, safe distance from the storm to watch the snow, wondering about the peak that disappeared an hour or so ago. The trees above the 14th floor. Where is the forest? Mosses, humus, tomorrow's worms, and rotting wood. Where is Earth? In hiding? How long will he wait, the fury calm? His contentment, chains of mountains, in someone's distant memory, a gaping wound, a smolder, healing balm so recently applied, to give the fragile errant child a little peace of mind. And we take from him ungratefully, without cause or estimate of cost against the unknown debt, forgotten stars, cold mountain water, ocean air. Rugged beauty, stock in trade for penthouse gardens, freeway parks. We are strong, we shout in pride. We control, we think, we know. We are so small. What comfort can we offer to our gracious host? What gentleness have we to give that will compare with eagles' wings, forget-me-nots, evergreens, or horses lying down? Sanctus. Flies buzz up against transparent barriers, thinking of them as if by thence they entered, but now cannot exit. One-way window. How often it seems we turn around to get out, but cannot find our entrance. Doors to communication, love, shut automatically. No doorkeepers. Take command! From where? Who? Of what? Are patterns torn in the world, or only folded? Is destiny what we subconsciously create for ourselves and each other? Are there patterns? Is there destiny? What have we done? What can we do? Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty, heaven and earth are full of thy glory. There occurs an accident on playground equipment every 4 minutes. Blessed is he who cometh in the name of the Lord. Hosanna in the highest. Do you think that I have come to give peace on earth? No, I tell you, but rather division. There is a fire in Gilead, a most terrible fire. A new heaven and a new earth accompanies every newborn child. One person lives in my world. Is it me? Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty. Heaven and earth are full of chaos. Hosanna in the highest. The next two I used as a Vespers last fall. A story called Sagenhaft, which is a creation legend that I was asked to write. Following that, a prayer that goes with it. In the beginning, before anything that now is was, there existed only a compassionate spirit that had been from all eternities. The spirit had no need of anything, no food or shelter from the cold, as food and shelter and cold did not yet exist. But in the wave of the folds of eternity, the spirit had the beginnings of the first emotion, and that emotion was loneliness. For the spirit felt the need to manifest its emotion in a physical realm, and in feeling this emotion incarnate, the spirit shed a tear. This spirit tear fell throughout the void of what is now the universe, and when reaching the roof of deep heaven, struck the roof and shattered, much as the first drop of rain upon the earth in spring. In shattering, the tear spun from one edge of the cosmos to the other, leaving traces of where it had gone. And these traces were called stars. And the spirit tear returned to its creator, having fulfilled the purpose for which it was shed. And the spirit was no longer lonely, for it now had the stars to keep it company. The spirit was so pleased it laughed for joy, and the laugh rolled away the barriers, separating the elements of light from each other, and the elements of light were now together, and light became. Yet there was not enough of light to completely dispel dark, so still to this day, dark is waiting in the corners of the cosmos, waiting to show itself when light is not looking. The spirit was much pleased with the light, but it did not know quite what to do with the light. So the spirit put through its infinite mind an image of all the things it could think of. But the spirit realized that there was no one world that could contain all the things it wanted. So the spirit created the galaxies with all their worlds to contain all the things the spirit wished to imagine. But still, the spirit was alone. So the spirit looked around throughout all of its galaxies for suitable worlds on which to create a being that would keep the spirit company, and it decided on a handful of worlds, one of which we now call Earth. And the spirit saw in its mind a being, and that being was human. And the spirit liked what it saw, and it was thus so on the suitable worlds. And the spirit felt a third emotion, pride. And the spirit thought, I must make it known that it is I who have so beautifully experienced these emotions. So it made itself known to us, and it called itself God. And to keep us in harmony with itself, and so that we could remember from generation to generation who had created all these wonderful things, the spirit gave us language, reason, and the sciences. But we abused these gifts and made ourselves unfit for the company of the spirit, so the spirit once again was lonely. But to keep us from becoming too lonely, since we cannot create from nothing to manifest our emotions, the spirit gave us music and all the arts. And that is why, to this day, in all the worlds we are on, we have forever been striving to please the spirit with our songs, arts, and images of all the spirit has done, since deep down in our hearts, we know that the spirit is still lonely. O thou, loneliest of all, our feeble, inconsistent prayers reach out to you like the candles in this darkened room. Our light is dim and offers little warmth. But hear us and be with us, Lord. We need you near us. In the deepest center of our being, we need you. And in some small way, you need us, too. Keep reaching out to us, O Spirit. Tug our weary heartstrings and bring us to follow your voice. The second set that I'd like to share with you are poems and stories that have to do with how I perceive myself, how I perceive myself and my relationships to the people around me. Obviously, these pages are not numbered. Sure. This is a poem that I later used as lyrics for a song. It's called A Good Long Time. I've been trying to figure out how I really feel about you. I look at you and see myself. I see you in my mind and behold a stranger. I cannot see the end of your beautiful eyes with the fire at the center. I dreamed once of your presence near, your brown and flaming hair an endless inch or two beyond my eyes, and my heart sang and cried, pained and jubilant. We walk and talk, the two of us, and I hear your gentle voice, sometimes older than its years, hesitant, but confidently opening doors to let the inner lights and emptinesses flood our togetherness. I hear my own voice, eager to confide, encouraging intimacy perhaps too strongly, too quickly. I sense your caution and think I've gone too far. And you come up to me with a clear smile and pleasure in your voice, telling me little things and big things, and suggest future plans like we've been together for years. And I wonder if you have any idea how much I want to be with you, one-on-one, for a good long time. bitter bread. At the center of my being, fastened to my soul, it starts, a staple of my daily life. If I let it be, it proves itself. Larger it looms, bubbling larger, symbolic behavior. This is no good. My pain and my messed upness, like my bitter bread. I need it, and it will grow large again and again until I bake it, put it through the fire, and it becomes fixed and digestible and life-sustaining and still bitter. Pied Piper's Pencil. I always used to write poetry with a pencil, often clumsily whittled to a blunt black end with my lousy knife and without eraser, before I learned to cross out and go on. I always used to sit at a tortured old desk facing the wall away from the window, toward my books and the old salt-sprayed ship's lantern I found on the beach. And like Ray said to me this afternoon, the flute was a big part of those sitting pencil days before I awoke, and life became too removed to even dream about. That tarnished silver voice was better to me than anything then. It haunted me with the sound of its own world, and I followed, inside and down, further into the sea mist and salt snow. And now, as I sit huddled on dripping winter's dark porch, with my dull pencil and old notebook, I close my eyes, and in a weary young dream, I hear again my soul. This next is called Scripsit, which is a word that calligraphers use to identify themselves at the bottom of a piece of work. Scripsit. The pen in my hand resists the paper like an unwanted scribe alone in the corner, silent. I am. I am dark and heavy, black ink on brown paper, poor words to deaf people, flowerless funeral. I am long, cold winter, wet wood on cracked hearthstones, Christmas with strangers, recurring nightmare. I am wreckage. I am cinders. I am rust. This is called Just Desserts, which was written as a birthday poem to a friend in Seattle who was trying to convince herself that if she could only find the right kind of cigarette, she would stop smoking. I used to smoke my cigarettes like I was drinking water. A glass a day, or three or four, and nothing was the matter. But water's not as sweet as wine, which is by far the richer. An after-dinner drink is purchased by the glass, not pitcher. So now I've started buying cloves and smoking like a miser. My just desserts are cultured air, and habit is the wiser. End of set two. This next set are poems about people that I've known. The first was written for the same person in Seattle. And I better not say any more or I'll give her away. It's called I Know a Compulsive Hostess. I know a compulsive hostess. Her hair is short and straight, efficient. Her movements have a standard grace. Her gait is comfortable and proud. She fills her shoes. My glass is down a swallow, and here comes more. I'm sure I won't be cold, but she knows better. I like my Class B cigarette, my northern blood, my shrinking drink. I like my shabby hair, my craziness, my savoir-faire. And I like compulsive hostesses. These next two are both called Before a Letter 1 and Before a Letter 2. I was reading a lot of Theodore Rethke's poetry at the time, so these have a real different feel to me than the others do. Before a Letter 1. At 5:09, a moment's fast sweat, start from sleep, the cold, the fake autumnal air, through the crystal's atmospheric dividend, quiet tears. The flat bells again ere long, winter singing death to silent cry withal, the hollow ear, the cut boot, the torn love, bedded with confusion. Wake without fear, no solitude complete in pain, a hollow eye beneath my rumpled hair, a blonder curly image, fades in vain. Before a Letter 2. Time-worn, the dazzled image. City, green, cloud blue, cement and glass. Your ocean, salty air about it, so far away. Classrooms, universal. Clock, move. Out. Done. Is it? Authority, wisdom, tradition, trust. Where are you inside your silence? A miser's scorch, your lost touch. The simple meal incomplete, too hot. My pencils break. Say cheese. This next is a story, which is written in a rather stream of consciousness style. You will recognize a lot of the places in this story and a lot of the general phenomenon if you've ever been here in the summer. This is called Time Will Tell. Looking back on it now, it seems so clear the way things got started, but seeing it for the first time then wasn't nearly so easy. Not that it's easy now, but when somebody slips sideways into your life and sort of stays there, it's hard to figure out where they came from and how and why and what you're going to do with them, or what they're going to do with you, now or later. It's even tricky to see what all you've done to each other, which is what I'm trying to do here now. This is called Time Will Tell, partly because it's the name of a song that has to do with this stuff, with me and him later on, but partly because it's the way things are right now, up to the minute, as of this writing kind of thing. Apropos, good French word for all the good it does me when I'm trying to get to sleep at night. It was lunchtime. I remember that clearly enough, and I can fake it and be safe to say that the sun was out, and it was June, and the dining room was fuller than it had been in a while, after winter was over and before the summer really got underway. Lots of new staff came into the village right around then, so there were always new faces across the table. I hadn't really planned to sit with him. I didn't know him or anything about him, and the sight of his back didn't really compel me to want to say hi or anything. But the empty chair was there, and I was hungry, and that was persuasion enough. I was late, I think. But anyhow, whether it was right away or after I got up to snag some peanut butter from the buffet and came back, it doesn't matter. He was chatting with a couple girls across the table and around the pillar from me. I figured he knew them, so I was just busy with my lunch. But there was a lull somewhere, and one of us said hi. It was probably him, but who knows? Some conversations kind of talk themselves, and sometimes you have to fight your tongue and your brain for every word. At least, that's the way it's always been for me. But this one, talking with him for the first time, was full of spontaneous comments, sometimes just being polite, sometimes really interested. Lots of silences, it seemed. That was the strange part, the silences, like they were okay or something. That and the way he would really look at me when I was talking to him. Not many guys will do that without getting afraid or jittery or trying to play some power game, but his blue soul windows just stayed open and said, "Hello, how are you? I really want to know." Small talk, like the little bits of wire they start with to build a cement bridge or something. He said, "Are you on staff?" And I said, "Yeah, are you?" And he said, "Yeah, what do you do?" And I said, "I'm a cook. What are you going to be doing?" And he said, "I'm going to be a waitry." That was how he said it, and stuff. No heavy questions, no extraordinary stuff as far as I recall, but by the time lunch was over, I felt a little strange. I liked the guy. I hoped I'd see him again. I figured I would. We'd be working together in the same building, no big deal. Except it was weird. I'm not that open with people I don't know. I'm not so open with the folks I call my own sometimes. And here I am on the level and walls down with this guy I just met. That still seems strange to me now. So the summer started with the steam puffing out of the sauna and the mass migrations of people from Midwestern anywhere, strangers for a hug, and the same six questions at every meal. He just kind of faded to what seemed like an inevitable summer stranger across the counter. Every once in a while, an enigmatic smile, those windows of his still open at me with some real stuff inside. But like I said before, circumstance can do a lot, and things were busy for me, and he lived in the lodge with everybody else, so our paths didn't cross much. Every once in a while, we'd be working the same kind of schedule, and circumstance would take over again, and I'd find myself sitting across the table from him over a late lunch. You know how they would always reserve that long back table for the kitchen and dining hall staff? And me being a cook and him being a waitry, we'd end up eating after everybody else. And sometimes we'd have conversations that I can't call ordinary. Like this one time, he looked at me over his bowl of soup and asked, "Do you think the material and spiritual worlds overlap?" And I said, "Definitely." And we floated around in neo-consciousness for a while, stirring our lentil soup or whatever wholesome non-mystical thing it was to eat. Lunch is like that. And sometimes I'd feel eyes on me while I was working. I don't know who it was, but it felt like his eyes. And sometimes he'd catch me, or almost catch me, watching him over my carrot chopping or whatever. Distant curiosity. Who is this person? Then there was this woman working in the kitchen, came to the place for the first time a couple days before I came back. We were sweeping the bakery one afternoon, and she just kind of asks me what my life story is, and I was feeling risky, so I pretty much told her. And things happened. We hang around a little, and we do some meditating together, and we talk. And after a while, my warning lights start to flicker on. Watch this closely, it feels like a little more than I'm asking for. And sure enough, one afternoon we walk and talk and psych up, and she says, "You see, I'm kind of interested in you." And I say, "Well, I'm flattered, but I'm not really responding. It's like this." And so she knows about me, and we have some good talking after that, and we spend the summer every once in a while talking and still meditating, and it's cool. And then she was living down the hall from him, and she started spending her time with him, and they kind of got sort of involved. I don't know about all that. That's her story, not mine. But she turned into sort of a relay between him and me, every once in a while making some comment that he said about me, and I assume saying the same to him. Strange stuff, he said, too, the kinds of stuff that was new to me from a man's mouth. Like, I had a good aura, and he wished he knew me better. And he heard about my plans for school, and he said I was too broad-minded for that. That stuff. So I kind of knew he was interested in me somehow, but that doesn't say anything. Then it was July later on, and it was my afternoon off, and I was hanging out up at the cook's place, writing and thinking about a shirt, and just kicking back. There's this cake in the oven. Looks kind of strange and pretty well overdone, but I figured it's somebody else's project, and I'm here for the ride. So I'm out on the porch, and somebody comes into the house, and it's him. It's his project that's going splaw in the oven. And I said, "I was going to have a beer. Do you want one?" "Sure," he says, and we take our bottles. He says his brother always calls this kind green death. Back out on the porch and try to be kind about killing the flies and talk some more. Longer subjects with no soup to stir. And he tells me about this therapy he's into and how life is 80% more enjoyable to him now than it used to be. And it makes me think. And all the time, he's so open and, like, refusing to let me not be open, too. Then it's back to work for him. Good afternoon. And I'm sitting out on the porch wondering what has just happened to me. This guy is getting better and better, and I ask my beer bottle, but it doesn't have anything to say, and I don't either. Meanwhile, he started hanging around when she and I do our meditation. He's trying to learn it, but she and I are into it for ourselves and don't feel like teaching. We want to meditate. So he burns out, but he still hangs around. You guys are going so slow, and I can't keep up. But he's around, and that makes me feel kind of strange, but so what? He always has, right? And other times, too. There was one night when I was really out into my own space, not real happy, but burning out and hanging in there, and I'm out sitting on the wall behind the hotel listening to something mellow on my tape deck and smoking, and they come laughing out of the building when I'm on my way in, and she gets really strange and hugs my knees. Okay, it's weird, and I'm not really into it, having my knees hugged. And I'm looking at his eyes like, what is going on here? And the next thing I know, she's laughing in my eyes and he's hugging my knees saying, maybe there's something to this. What now? So I put it away and keep to myself like before. I still don't get that one. And another night, I was transferring my recital from the master reel to a cassette. He said he wanted to hear my stuff, so I told him and he said, I'll be there. No show. I found out later that the two of them decided they wanted to bitch at somebody, so they went off and bitched at each other. He did that instead of hearing my music. From here in the present, I can label that feeling, more important than me. But from there, it just hurt and got stashed. I don't remember the first time I hugged him, or if it was him hugging me. Every Sunday up there is like body-touching night. Folks get to the part of the church service where they pass the peace, and it can last for 10 minutes. No handshakes, except for the guests that just came in, and they kind of freak out. So it was probably a Sunday night, but I don't remember. But I do remember his hugs. They're like he's strong and soft and wise and like a little kid. He doesn't patch on the back like burping. And he isn't afraid to really get in close. You know, some people hug like they'll only touch your shoulders, but not him. It really got to me, his hugs. Not like, oh wow, but like sadness almost. Like crying, like just being there was enough. And the communication happened without thinking about it, daring me to be open and warm and spread the hurt around a little thinner, or send a little care out with my touch or something. They're still that way, coming up on a year later and after all this stuff I haven't told you about yet, and it still gets to me. Then later on, we're into August now, and I realize that my time up there is getting down from months into weeks, and I haven't been out to do any wandering around in the mountains or anything, and I was telling him that one afternoon, and he says, there's a bunch of us going up to this place next week. Do you want to come along? That makes me really happy, like I'm important enough, and plus I want to get out and hike, so I say, you bet, and it's on. Well, the time comes up, and he starts talking like he wants to leave town for a couple days instead. And I'm not feeling important anymore. And I tell him, look, I don't know you very well, but what I know I really like. So if you've got to let off some steam, I hope you feel free to. See, part of his leaving town for him was to get some of the bad stuff out of his system. And the group to hike starts disbanding. And pretty soon it's just me and him and her. And we're going down to the lake for a couple nights instead of the mountains. Okay, it's going to be fun. I pack my stereo and rip off some herbs so we can eat good stuff. And we're set. It was one of the strangest and most intense times of my whole life. I still think so, and it'll take a lot to change that. Tripping down the path that afternoon, setting up the tent, starting supper, ordinary stuff, but it was just like, do what you want, and if nobody wants to do that stuff, we'll do without it. And everything got done. Strange. And the fire that night, talking and crying and laughing and listening to music, I'll never forget this. He was crying, and he looked over at me and said, hold my hand. And I felt enormous, and I held his hand, trying to be there and be supportive for him, and he felt better. We were sitting there later, the three of us quiet, watching the flames like campers always do, and listening to the lake, and he gets up from his seat and comes over and sits down real close to me and puts his hand on my shoulder. No words, just a hand on my shoulder, comfortable, casual, loaded. I still have a scar from that care. The next day was just a laid-back, lying out on the dock, reading or talking or doing nothing kind of day until it started to rain that evening. They were up in a cave reading a book and throwing ideas back and forth about being male in the 80s, and it just didn't thrill me. Gay men have no stereotypical relationships with women, so why get involved with all of this crap? So I was down writing to myself, getting wet in spite of the tent, and decided that I wasn't having a good time and that I was going to walk back up the road that night, rain or no, and I went up and said so. And a strange thing again, he looks at me with that clear blue like before and says, I think I'll come along. So we get it all set, and she stays there because she wants to, and he and I start up the road. 4 hours in a different reality is all I can say about that walk. It was really raining, and then the thunder and lightning started, and we were both wet to the skin after half an hour, but we kept walking. We were wearing our swimsuits under our clothes just in case, so it was okay. And the talk. The world was changing all around us. Grayish sights and strange dim lights following along the road sometimes, and the sword in the road and getting hungry and sitting down in the middle of nowhere for a picnic in the pouring rain, and stopping every now and then to retie shoelaces or some such thing, and he says, "Do you mind if I touch you?" And I say, "Feel free." We got back to town at something like 1:30 in the morning and went immediately to the jacuzzi, which felt very good. And I took my heart in my hands and said, "I'll swap a back rub with you." And he said, "Sure." So we did, me first. And it was so hard to not just take him in my arms and care for him like a little kid. But I minded my job as well as I could, which I think was pretty well. And he got a good back rub. And even though it was dark, I could see the look in his eyes when I was finished and easing myself back into the water. And I still wonder what it meant. Then after a while later, he touched my back. He didn't seem very comfortable and couldn't let his hands do the massaging instead of his brain, which seemed strange to me. He seemed usually to be so sensory, more than analytical. I looked at him when he was done, too, but he didn't look back. And I still don't know what that was about, either. Seems to me that was during the week sometime, like a Wednesday. And it was that weekend that I wrote that song about him, the one that's called Time Will Tell, like this story is. I sang it to him soon after that. I was really full of caring for the man, and I wanted to get it all in the open with him, but I wanted to do it slow, so I told him before I started singing that it was about him. My back was to him the way the piano was in that building, and I heard him moving around while I was at the piano, and I wondered what was going over. Then afterward, he sat down next to me close on the piano bench and hugged me with, "Thank God for you." And he was crying, and I still didn't know what to do, but I felt sad and happy all at once, like, this man is my friend, and I want to be with him for a lot longer than the next week until I leave. A trend that week, every night it would be later on, and I would be milling around like I do, maybe spending some time with friends or whatever, but afterwards I would find myself just kind of wandering around without any real reason, and I would run into him, and I would know that I'd been kind of seeking him out, and he would tell me that he'd been kind of looking for me too. A couple walks that week, he was really upset one night, and we went down the road a bit, and he was crying, and I almost automatically put my arm around him to keep walking. A little later, he thanked me for doing that, and I felt huge again. Important enough and making a difference to a man that I loved. Those were precious times for both of us, I think. I should ask him sometime maybe what he thought about that week and the trip up the road together and what. No matter what goes over from here, those are chiseled for me and they feel good. Then later that week, I went back down to the lake for a day, and the two of them came down later with another woman, and after a while I felt like it was now or never, and he and I went for a walk and I told him I was in love with him. "Would I want to be soulmates with him?" he asked me. It blew me away that he'd be thinking that profound, and I said, "Yes." He asked me if that meant we were gay, and I told him I was, and that's where the trouble started, because it's really a touchy subject for him for a lot of reasons, and I just kind of put everything on a wait-a-minute-here kind of feeling. Bummer. But he was still warm, just not as open or something, like a cloud cover. I walked back by myself that night and didn't have a very good time of it either. So this is where it gets hard to keep stuff in order and close to true. It happened so fast after that, a couple of long talks and the subtle pushing from me and the subtle phobia from him. I don't want to turn this into a quick roll in the hay or what, but I won't deny that I'd really like us to be one-on-one for a few hundred years either. Am I in the present already? So much for chronologizing. I've got to get back to it, though. There's so much more to say. I went off to school just like I said I would and just like I didn't want to. I left him a letter and a copy of the lyrics from his song and the cross from my bag of special things. And I went to school and I waited to hear from him, writing more poetry about him and being lonely and not knowing what was going on. He wrote once, a letter that told me only that he didn't know what was going on either, though he didn't say anything about it. Some letters are like that, you know, they say more by what they don't say than from what they do. And while he was home and I was back east, he was busy telling his brother all about it, about me and her too, I guess, from what I've heard lately, playing the tape I made for him of my music, and seems like just generally being on his mind sometimes. Good feeling, I'm important enough. Though there were complications later. then school got to be too much, and being away from him got to be too much, and the weather and not being with mountains and ocean and everything else, so I bagged it and flew back out to his city and got an apartment and tried living. I called him the day I got in. We talked a little. He sounded kind of uncomfortable and all, but didn't sound like he didn't want to hear from me again or anything. More confusion. I can skip some of this next part, I think. That's more my story, unless this one about him and me. The stuff about getting so depressed and going into therapy, except to say that it was this therapy that he was into. And I'm glad, and I went where he did, and that was a complicating step too, but I'm glad I did, for myself, regardless of him. Sometime during the first couple weeks of November, I needed to go to this town a ways away for some memories to get the move on and get back up into consciousness. So I called him, because he had a car, to see if he would drive me down there. He said he would, not too many questions, because he knows the kind of thing those kinds of trips can mean. So we went, the first time I'd been alone with him since August, and it's mid-November, and we lock ourselves into a car for 6 hours. Strange. The lines from that day that stick in my mind. "I'll pay you for part of this gas," he says. I say, "That's okay, I don't think much about money with the people I trust. Do you trust me?" he asks. I had to say that I never could decide whether I did or not, so I supposed I did. And his line, we got into gayness on the way back, my introduction, and he said I was just outside his comfort zone right now. We talked on the phone a couple times during those months, but I didn't see him again until mid-December at the Christmas party held by and for all the therapy people, and we didn't really talk that night just as well. One complication was that by this time I'd gotten to know his brother pretty well, and we were friends. Another complication was that she had moved to town and started in on this therapy too, so we were still all in this together with no real escape to speak of. Strange, I was just as close to her as I'd ever been, and to this day we have good talks and enjoy each other's company. Haven't seen or heard from his brother in a while, but he knows about me too, and we've had some good times together. But then it was January. A friend from out of town was staying with me for a visit, and he called, surprise, to say, "Could we get together before I go back up to the mountains for a couple months? Sorry, but there's no time. I really wanted to, but my alliances with my other friend were a lot more immediate than with him," so I said. So he's out of town again. Not that it makes any difference to me day to day or anything, unless it makes things easier, since I don't have to deal with his being here and us not getting together. My not being important enough. Then another friend called to say, "I'm coming to visit in February. Let's go up to the mountains for a couple days to see everybody." And I said, "Sure," even though I knew he was up there. So I talked to his brother, and he wanted to go too, which was great for me, somebody to take his time, so I can feel free to spend time with other people, like my visiting friend. And we got up there, and it didn't quite work. I don't understand this next part at all yet, and I think if I ever will, I'll still get it wrong. We were up there just staying kind of light and strangers until the second night, just before supper, and that sadness crept into his eyes, and he said some heavy stuff on me about his not being very happy there and all, and I didn't know what to do about it. It made me mad that he would dump it on me after leading me on and dragging me through all that shit last fall, but I guess I still care about and for him, so I listened, halfway getting involved, but I just couldn't get into it. It hurt too much still. And he gave me a note the next day as we were leaving that sounded like, "I'm sorry, goodbye," but never said so. And I wrote him a letter when I got home that says, "Isn't life full of surprises?" And, "Let's not call it quits until we stop triggering each other's shit and find out what we're really like." And I sent him another letter full of just general stuff about how I am and asking about how he is and telling him about feeling like everything else is more important than me to everybody and true personal stuff like that. Still no answers from the mountains. He hasn't written, and it seems just like September again, except it's March, and things are blooming and growing and coming up green, instead of getting gray and dirty and ready for cold all over my life. And I have to wonder how he feels and what might happen in the next few months or the next year or whenever. He's coming back to town in a couple weeks, if I remember right, and I'm leaving town in about a month. Not much time to do any moving at all, being at building or tearing down or sitting on a pile of construction wire talking about the project. Though I guess I still feel like I want to be close to him. I know I do. And I know too that I want it, whether we're a couple or friends or however it might happen. I love him, is all. Time will tell, I guess. When every once in a while I see on the edge of my surroundings a glint of gold striding easy, or leaned intimately in a corner intent on 6 strings of music, and when I can't really see it under gray wool above a half-created gift of strong dexterity with yarn, knitted furrows in youngish brows, and an almost sweater, I know the gold is there. And when I hear his voice, rough with treasure like sifted ore, gentle words and songs and shining laughter, sometimes tarnished by old immediate pains, my soul glows with the ancient coins my friend has hidden. Next, I'll read four love poems that I wrote. The first is called "Here Is My Heart." Here is my heart, thou gentle thief, take this once tepid bread that you have warmed. Here is my heart, piece by piece it disappears. You ask for nothing, but your careless pen will take the rest away in clumsy, brilliant words before too long. So take it all. And take my slow replies and scars, and let me give away my heart while some of it is mine. The View from the Porch. The dark, chaotic sky, confusion of the Milky Way, God flies a quiet kite, and mythic swans parade. The air is calm, a distant voice reclaims my ears, and porch light sings a lullaby. I sing to you, so far away. You see the swan, and God dips you a drink of solitude like me. I close my eyes, and in my cigarette, your kiss might burn. Fantasy. In my mind, you're at a party somewhere. You chat and smile, you pull your beer. You laugh. In my mind, you place another stitch. You tie a loom. You set another poem. You sigh. In my mind, you read behind my door. You rest your limbs. You pull the covers close. You wait. In my mind, your thoughts take other shape. Your world is other things. Your love has other hands. You live. And in my heart, I'm here alone. To think 100 years ago I knew your eyes, those open doors of love and trust through which we'd pour each other's hearts, the hurts, the gentle healing light. I've sometimes seen them like a dimly fading dream in memory's indifferent dawn. Your tousled hair bequeathed to me the faintest hint of touch, just brushed like breath upon my brow or fingertips asleep. I knew you as myself sometimes. The things I've heard from other lips, I know you'd said in murmured days and nights of solid, tender thoughts put into words. Your laugh within me sometimes when I smile. And then the nights I wake abruptly, senses filled with scrubbed and earthy smells that linger from your strong embrace, which always drew me after passion into dreams. And now the days and nights of waiting. As I seek, remembering but fragments of our other past, I ask you, have your memories been just as close and dimly full of me as mine have been of you? Perhaps by holding to our dream of future years together, we can cause our lonely paths to meet and join our hands and mated souls again in peace. These next two are kind of a set. One is a very short poem called Lay Lie. The second is called Coffee and My Heavy Heart. Laying in the sun, trying to write about you, my words fall asleep. You were beside me, gentle touch and forked tongue both lying in my bed, Oh, water not the ancient grounds whereon my eyes have stayed awake. Pour not thy scalding, saltless tears o'er aromatic darkness. Take away the heat and whistled sounds of passion spent in bygone days, and let my bitter drink of years, unpoured for unknown others' sake, flow free in other waterways. The last thing in this set is a short story called Beetle, and was inspired by riding the New Wave bus from downtown Seattle to the university every morning. Beetle was a wonderful girl. That's what everybody said, but I'm not so sure. She always seemed just kind of strange to me. Sure, she was part of the para-punk following, you know, the type that wears bizarre clothes and has an uneven haircut, however consistent, but still gets an allowance from her parents and secretly goes to the Saturday matinees without telling anybody. Her para-punk friends, that is. Wouldn't look good, you know, going to a show with the little kids in the middle of the day when you should be hanging around downtown, being cool and getting disapproving looks from the business types. She liked the sad movies best, the ones where the boy and girl fall in love and then one of them dies. But she would never say that. Hey, Beetle, didn't I see you coming out of that trashy movie on Saturday afternoon with all those kids? Who, me? Nah, never. Must have been somebody else. Who'd go to something like that and get in with that crowd? Ooh, yuck. And then she'd be more careful next time and wear a hat that was real bourgeois and go to a theater that was a ways from the bus lines. Beetle's parents liked her too, which was another strike against her. I mean, don't get me wrong, they couldn't relate to about half of her clothes and most of the people she hung out with, and they couldn't dance to her music or speak her dialect. But they were cool, and it was cool, and they didn't freak out when she used 4 cans of hairspray in a week, or if she was gone for a couple days now and then. They left notes for her, little yellow things that she would find stuck in places they knew she would get into. And though she'd never admit it, she kind of liked it. Like, she'd feel loved and secure and all those underneath-type feelings that don't ever really get through to the surface until after you turn 21. In the shower. Beetle, hi, we love you. We're going to a Chinese restaurant on Thursday at 5:30 if you want to come. Dad. Inside the refrigerator, stuck to the apple drawer. Beetle, hi, we love you. These are a new kind. If you like them better, check here. Mom. Stuck to her record player. Beetle, hi, we love you. Ricky called on the 19th and said you can borrow her Rockabilly record. Mom. On a sweater in her dresser drawer. Beetle, hi, we love you. This is from Billy, who said you loaned it to her last month and she doesn't like it anymore. Dad. P.S. It's a groovy sweater. Sometimes she would get sneaky when they weren't home and would snag a cigarette from her mom's secret stash or would rummage through the back of her dad's closet for an old tie that was funky enough. She thought she was being so smooth until the day she found a little yellow note on the inside door of the liquor cabinet. Beetle, hi, we love you. Sometimes it really bugged her that it didn't seem to matter what she was doing or who she was hanging out with or anything. They were still there saying, hi, we love you. But after a while, that feeling would go away. And there was one time she was really glad they were there. Hello? Hi, Mom, this is Beetle. I'm downtown, and God, I'm pregnant, and I'm coming home in an hour. Will you still be home? Please be home. I'm scared. You bet. Do you want Dad here, too? No, yes. I don't know. I have to go now. The bus is here. Bye. Click. Bye. We love you. And she came home and stayed home for nearly a week, talking and crying and wondering what to do. But after the abortion, she cried some more and talked some more, finally started laughing again and dressed up and left. They weren't even fazed about school. Every once in a while, Mom or Dad would get a call from a teacher or an attendance principal or someone like that, and whichever of them got the call would be polite and say the right things to pacify the officials and sometimes make two-sided promises. Don't you understand the gravity of this situation? Students such as your daughter are eroding the structure of our educational system. Well, really, do you think it's that serious? Very serious indeed. These children, with their erratic behavior and fundamentally distasteful appearance, could attract a kind of cult following. You know how impressionable they are at this age, and that would be a tragedy for everyone. Well, since you put it that way, and think of what could happen. No order in the classroom. Overt violence right here on the school grounds. Theft, vandalism, drug traffic, inappropriate physical interaction. The list is endless. All right, I'll have a talk with Beetle the very minute she steps foot in the house. I'm sure she and I can reach an understanding. And a note would appear on the microwave oven door. Beetle, hi, we love you. The social studies teacher called again. Smile at him tomorrow, okay? But like I said, most people thought that Beetle was a wonderful girl. I sat across from her in fifth period English when she was there. I think she kind of liked me, but I could never tell, and it wouldn't be cool for me to say anything to her, because the people I hung around with didn't hang around with the people that she hung around with. And except for fifth period English, we never saw each other. Towards the end of that year, when we were starting to think about graduation, very different thoughts, I'm sure, and we were all having our portraits taken, she seemed kind of withdrawn, like upset about something. I kind of asked around, talked to a couple people who were a social unit halfway between her and me, and they said she was okay, just quiet. But I know people a little bit, so I decided I'd ask her myself and see what was really going over, if she wanted to say anything to me about it. About a week went by, and I was just waiting for my chance. English didn't seem like a really good time to say anything, because there were so many people around, and it would be really hard to sound sincere and all. So I thought, and I thought, and I placed myself in strategic places around the school, but I never ran into her, and I was getting frustrated. I mean, I'd taken this on as a special project, sort of like making quilts for Aborigines or something, and it wasn't working. And I thought and thought some more, and finally had a flash of inspiration. I called and left a note. Her mom was real friendly, but didn't really want to say much about where Beetle was or when she'd be home. I figured she must be really protective or something. She kind of laughed and said she didn't know. Maybe it was true, but I don't know many parents who are like that. But she said that she would write a note and leave it someplace where Beetle would be sure to find it. I believed her. 3 or 4 days later, I was sitting in English, and Beetle came in late. Nothing new, you understand. And she was wearing a new sweater, but she still looked kind of quiet. And when she sat down, she had a little yellow piece of paper stuck to her notebook, and it said, "Beetle, hi, we love you. A guy named Alan called who sits next to you in English, and he said he was hoping you were okay. Mom." Beetle kind of poked her head at me. It would have been a toss of the head, but hairspray has a way of changing the way you express yourself, I guess. And she had another little yellow piece of paper stuck to her notebook, but all it said was, "Hi," and she peeled it off and stuck it to the side of her desk so it was facing me. It was so subtle. So after class, when everybody was standing up getting their stuff together, I kind of casually said, "Hi," then realized that I didn't have a clue what to say to somebody who pastes their hair into strange shapes and wears huge raggy clothing, and there was one horrible second where I was looking at her and she was looking at me, and it was obvious to both of us that I should say something, but I couldn't think of what to say, and I knew that she knew that's what was going on, but I just couldn't help it. I wanted to say, "You look weird," because that's what was on top of my mind. But I knew that wouldn't help, so I just kind of fumbled around with some imaginary thing in my coat pocket and finally said the second thing which came to mind, which was, "Got a cigarette?" And she looked at me and tried real hard not to laugh, and I realized just how stupid that was to say, and I tried real hard not to be totally embarrassed, and she laughed, and I blushed. And she said, "Sure." So we left, and we both skipped our last period class, and we went out to the back of the parking lot and sat on the curb and smoked her cheap cigarettes. After a while, when we were done talking about smoking and about cigarettes, she said, "So what's with your note?" Not being accustomed to speaking with such bluntness, I was off guard again, and it was a couple minutes before I could finally tell her that I thought she was being kind of quiet, not like usual, and I was sort of curious about what might be wrong and if there was anything I could do about it, although I still found it difficult to look at her while I spoke. That hair! And she didn't react the way I thought she was going to. I mean, I thought either she'd be really offended or she'd get kind of mushy like, "Oh God, someone cares," or something. But she looked at me and said very calmly, "That's nice of you." Not even any sarcasm or anything. What do I say now? The silence was kind of long again, and I said, "Well, is there anything wrong?" "Not really, it's just, you know, leaving school and all that stuff." "Oh, yeah, sure, I know the feeling." Again, what now? This was not turning out like I thought it would. So I finally said, "Well, if you're really okay, then I won't worry anymore or anything." And she said, "Yeah, don't worry. It's not good for you." And she smiled, and I kind of smiled, and we got up and walked back to school, and she went to her bus stop, and I went to mine, and that was it. See you tomorrow, in English. I would have thought that that would have been it between me and Beetle. But a couple years later, I was in the throes of my master's thesis at the U, and it just got to be too much, all those questions. So I cracked a beer and plopped down on the sofa to listen to the TV. Eyes closed to save the retina, all that stuff. And pretty soon I hear this voice, and it sounds kind of familiar. And I sit up and look, but I don't recognize the woman that's talking, but that voice is really familiar now, and I still can't place it. And then she says something about, back to you, Bill, and kind of tossed her head. Poke, toss, poke, toss, poke, and it connected, and I thought, good God, it's Beetle. And there she was on the evening news, looking like someone I'd never seen before. And with the coolest manner with the camera, I couldn't believe it. Who knows why, but the next thing I knew, I was at the typewriter with a piece of paper and the address of the TV station, and the paper was in and the date was on it, and I thought, I'm sure you're going to write a letter to this TV personality and address it to Beetle. Good move, Alan. You look weird. So I waited until they were done, and she said her name was Valerie. Wow, I never knew that before. Valerie. She sure looked more like a Valerie than she did like a Beetle. At least she did now. So I wrote the letter. Dear Valerie. And I thought, no way. And I started over again. Dear Ms. I thought, what was her last name again? And then I thought, why? So I took the paper and crumpled it into a little ball and hooked it at the garbage can in the kitchen and missed. Typical. That would have been the end of it for any sensible person, right? But I guess I'm not that sensible. A week later, I was knowledgeable about everything that was going on in the world, at least as much of it as they told me, as she told me every night. And I knew now that her last name was Joffrian. Luscious. And I still tried to write a letter, but it just wouldn't work. Dear Ms. Joffrian, you don't remember me, but... Do you remember in fifth period English there was a... I just want to say that I really like the way you do the... See what I mean? My roommate Greg was going crazy. I don't know what to do with you anymore. All you do is watch the news and think about this woman, Valerie. What's got into you? But listen, Greg, just listen to me for a minute. I sat next to her in fifth period English in high school. Yeah, I know. And she was a real punker, and everybody called her Beetle, and her parents used to leave little notes for her, and notes! They used to leave notes! That's it! I'll get some of those little yellow things, and I'll leave her a note. Wonderful idea, Greg, wonderful! Greg was not happy. But I went to the bookstore, and I bought a little pad of yellow note stuff and started in on it. Hello, Ms. Joffrian. Hi, Ms. Joffrian. Hello, Valerie. Hi, Valerie. Bummer. And then I found out who her friends were, and I sort of talked to one of them, but I made her promise never, ever to say anything to Valerie about it. And I found out where she always ate lunch, and where her apartment was, and all that stuff, so I knew just where to put a note once I figured out what to say. But it looked just as hopeless as ever. And then I remembered that Greg had the good idea to write a note, so why not ask him again? But I knew he wouldn't say a word unless I got him in the right mood. So one night after we'd been out for a few beers and he was pretty drunk, I waited until he was almost asleep and I got my voice down to almost a whisper and I said, Greg? What? You asleep? Yeah. What do I say to Valerie? Hi. What else? What? Beetle. Of course! Sure! Sorry. Of course. Thanks, Greg. Thanks a million. And the next day, a note appeared on her apartment door. The day after that, there was one in her mailbox, and then the door to the cafe she hung out at, and then her studio office and her car and even the tags on her terrier. That took a little doing, let me tell you. All over. And it happened. At the end of the news, it happened. She was all business for the whole hour, and then she smiled and tossed her head and said it. If anybody knows who has been putting these little notes everywhere I go, would you please drop me a... No, call me. I don't need any more notes. And let me know who this is so I can say hi personally. And she held up one of my notes and you could see it plain as day. Beetle, hi, we love you. Greg was on the phone before I could stop him, and he's bigger than me, so there was nothing I could do short of tearing the phone out of the wall. To this day, I don't know where he got the number. He must have been saving it up for weeks. But there he was, and he was asking for Valerie Joffrian, and she was on the line, and he said it was me. She must have asked, who? Because he said it again. Alan Strand, who used to sit next to you in fifth period English. And he held the receiver away and toward me, back in the corner where I was hiding behind the fireplace. And I heard her, and she was laughing. And I started laughing, too, and then Greg started laughing, and the neighbors pounded on the ceiling to say we were being too loud, and we laughed some more. And after a while, when I refused to talk to her, I was still blushing the next day. She hung up, and Greg and I went out and got drunk and laughed some more. And that's all I have to say about Beetle, except... About a week later, I was minding my own business and going in to give a test to the freshman class, and there she was, in the back row, just like she used to be, in the stiff hair and the big old black coat with the ugly tie, and she didn't even let me recover, and she got up and walked to the front where I was, and she took a big piece of yellow paper from her coat pocket, and took a big piece of tape from the desk, and stuck it to the board right in front, and it said, "Alan, hi, you look weird, but it's okay. Beetle." P.S. Are you still cute when you blush? And she left, and I died right there in front of all the freshmen, and I found out later that Greg had put her up to it and had a good laugh, so I could have killed him. But after a while, it was okay again. But I tell you, it'll be a long time before I start writing notes again. Though it was kind of fun. This last section will be fairly short. It's called, it's about poems about places and situations in which I find myself. Breakfast guest. Across the low table, he watched me, smiling. I offered him toast, potato, an egg. No response, just the warmth of his smile. He played with his empty glass, and light went everywhere. My bright silver shot sparks, threatening the curtains. After our meal, he moved into the living room, appreciating the crystals in my window. I liked them, too. I didn't have to ask what kind of music to play to suit his radiant buoyancy, and I didn't have to ask my friend, the sun, to come back sometime. When I was getting ready for my senior recital at college, a friend of mine that I went to high school with found out about it and decided that she was going to fly down from Anchorage for my recital, and fly right back. Well, it was a real busy time preparing for a degree recital where the faculty would come listen and decide whether or not you could graduate. I recorded it myself, and setting up the equipment, doing sound checks, trying to get rehearsal schedules together, all that kind of thing, and there wasn't much time for me to spend with her. And I felt kind of confused when she was there, like we weren't really communicating. Well, I wrote this poem. It's called 3 Days Later. The jug, much lighter and less green since Mother poured the water out, sits in quiet solitude on the corner of my desk, amidst efficient canisters of mints and metals, chemicals like laundry soap and aspirin. My work, abandoned like a sinking ship, founders near a candlestick. Ink and pencil markings tracing undergraduated thoughts, muse beginnings, rough-cut lumber, untanned hide. An orange and pink and yellow fire fades atop the dry, enlightened green. Death comes slowly. By the each, the petals fall upon the desk and cover stains of ink and years and memories. A single strand of long brown hair, souvenir. Your presence fades a little, gradually. The gentle waves of drudgery breaking on the subtle sides of your seaworthiness. The light is aging, and the universe prepares to sleep and wait and gaze with sightless eyes into the caverns of identity. Again, the notebooks call my name. The mirror dims, the past recedes, the flowers die, and dreams begin. Kaleidoscopes of emptiness. The next two are poems about weather. First one is a series of haiku called Autumn. Oh, come with me, wind. Let us collect the harvest of dry golden leaves. Let us rake them up with tools of silvery frost and of biting chill. Let us take a few of several different kinds of crops that farmers grow. Let us remind them that winter is on his way with cold, sleet, and hail. Let us remind them that with snow he also brings a blanket of death. But his mood can change. He brings fresh joy to children and to young at heart, who slide down the hills on sleds, skis, ice skates, and tires for a bit of fun, to be remembered years later over coffee as the good times passed, or to be relived in the minds of grandchildren of the years to come. But come along, wind. We must set out on our task of preparation, so that next year, too, there will be golden harvests for us to gather. Occasionally, I like to play with sonnets. This is a sonnet called "A Pedestrian Dreams About Consistent Weather." The distant splotchy colors of the earth against the rhododendron's scarlet bud, or maples groaning in a leafy birth, lend less assurance than the winter's blood enjoys the bitter warmth of summer skies, or than a child who giggles, prays, and lies. These in-betweennesses without a name, that wear their plumage shamelessly by day and sneak away in silence when the tame, uncertain April sun is called away by cloud or nightfall or some other ploy, persuaded by the wind's impending joy. This folly, this confusion every year about snow being gone for good, or when a daffodil's presence is secure, contents itself with nothing, as a hen without an egg will claim all as her own. The sky in spring can't leave itself alone. The next three are poems that I later turned into a song cycle for alto voice and piano, which I called Images of the Archipelago. These three poems were written over several years' time, and their common thread is that they all have something to do with the island in southeast Alaska where I grew up. First is called Reflection 2. I wonder if there ever be reflection like a fiery ball, whenever diamonds in the sea consider flying eagles' call. Perhaps a day we understand will lead us to return to flight upon the winds, to far-off lands where thought transformed becomes delight. Then on that day in future's time, the differences of space will tell just where the words take part in mime, and when the sun in snowflakes fell. The second is called Beckoning, and it's about a gift that was given me when I graduated from high school. An old pine box, brass fittings, a lock on one side, leather hinge, handmade, the kind that would be discovered under the bed or on a shelf somewhere, pictured in an old cabin. The waxwork in the rim and in the leather binding betrays oldness and simple weatherproofing. Good, honest things in the damp, cold closet spaces of the Alaskan islands. The die that furrows detail from carving on the face that sees with stylish eyes also speaks of passing time before oils and canvas, Evinrudes, Frigidaires, or glass. There are no cities in this box, or mantel clocks, or telephones. You hear the sea and night and fire. And listening very hard, you might behold the wood itself alive. The last is called Petersburg Winter. Petersburg was the town where I grew up, and in most respects it appears like any other ordinary little fishing town. And as I lived there, I noticed a few things that didn't seem to fit. the elements not doing what they were supposed to do, or light playing havoc with things that you could see across the bay, or little anomalies in artwork around the town. So Petersburg winter. With a wind of frost, winter rushes slowly upon the island. Chilly flags crown twig poles. Snow, blanched in atmosphere, layers itself silently on power lines, evergreens, sleeping dogs. In an eye of stained glass, an 11-fingered Christ and one lost lamb stare out in silence. No passion here. Farther up the hill, houses across the channel focus out to fantasy. Broken windows mend to lights out. Paint reappears. Habitation returns. Mysterious. Through a patch of cloudlessness, the constellations hide in stars thicker than water. Lights flicker on the buoy on the bay. The bell tolls for the incoming tide and for winter. The last poem I'd like to share with you is a poem I wrote after one of my housemates decided that all of our houseplants needed to be repotted. It's called Fear of Houseplants. Thirty-one houseplants. On the wood stove, some huddle discussing autumn. By the window, some are slow footprints of the sun possessing this room. Across the table, all gaze at one another, and at my notebook,